Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Turn on the television, surf the internet, open a magazine. Everywhere you look, celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow, Alex Jones, and Dr. Oz are promoting pseudo-scientific products. From jade eggs to homeopathic vaccines, these sorts of magic elixirs are at best snake oil, but at worst, they're dangerous, if not deadly. Not only are we inundated with bad scientific advice from advertisers and some media outlets, but the Trump administration appears to be waging a war on science itself. This hour on Point, how to cut through the quackery and get the facts. You can join us on air or online. Do you think science and scientific facts are under attack? How can you tell a fake expert from a real one? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, where they're at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is Dr. Paul Offit. Paul is the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and author of the new book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. You can find an excerpt of his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you again.
Thanks for having me on.
So for 20 years, you've been on the front lines in the fight for sound science. Let's first look at the problem of bad science. What is it? How would you define it? And generally, where does it come from?
Well, I would define it as misleading information, whether it's about vaccines or dietary supplements or megavitamins, where people then are sort of seduced into making decisions that negatively affect their health or their children's health. And I think as scientists, we need to stand up and try and fight that. The problem is that as you stand up and try and fight it, you find yourself being in the crosshairs of some very hostile forces that are meant on defeating you, whether it's celebrities or politicians or hostile activists or personal injury lawyers. Or the industries that you attack, I think it's an unpleasant surprise.
So talk more about that. The personalities, the hostile forces that you make reference to, who extol different treatments, sometimes unproven. The celebrities, the advocates, the lobbyists, and all the money behind them.
Right. I mean, so I'm a viral immunologist, and so my interest has been in trying to, work on, at least scientific interest was in collaborating with a team at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that eventually, invented a vaccine that was licensed and recommended for all children in this country in 2006. So in that process, I saw exactly how hard it was to make a vaccine to prove that it was safe and effective. And at the same time, I witnessed how easy it was to damn them and that there were groups out there who wanted to tell you that, vaccines could cause autism in your children. Oh, and by the way, we have, these supplements that can make your autism go away. It's just sort of this cottage industry of quackery that was designed to try and promote products that had no chance of helping. And worse, these activists were trying to convince parents not to vaccinate their children. And there's not a year that goes by at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia where we don't see a child admitted to the hospital with a vaccine-preventable disease because their parent made a choice not to vaccinate their child based on information they were getting from these groups, and the child has suffered and occasionally dies from these diseases. It's just hard to watch. And so I decided to try and get into the game to have my voice out there. You're trying to work through this very opaque window to get good information into the hands of people who can use it.
This book is beyond autism and vaccines, certainly. But to your point that you just made, here's an interview on 2008 on CNN. Jenny McCarthy, the former host of ABC's The View, insisting that her son's autism was caused by vaccinations. Here she responds to the assertion that children die from diseases that vaccines can help prevent.
People are also dying from vaccinations. Evan, my son, died in front of me for 2 minutes. So you ask any mother in the autism community if we'll take the flu, the measles, over autism any freaking day of the week.
And here's Andrew Wakefield. He wrote a paper published in the British medical journal The Lancet in 1998, linking the MMR vaccine to autism. His work was fraudulent, but convinced many parents that they should stay away from vaccines generally. Here he spoke to naturalnews.com in 2011 about the paper.
If those children had regressed after natural chickenpox, the story would have been told. There would be no censorship. No one would have questioned why we put in chickenpox. But because it happened after a vaccine, then it can't be spoken about. It is verboten. You know, it is forbidden. And no, that is not the way science works. Science will not be censored in that way. And it most certainly wasn't our job as scientists to censor the parent's story.
In 2010, The Lancet retracted Wakefield's article, noting that he had acted dishonestly and irresponsibly shortly after he was barred from practicing medicine in Great Britain. But Dr. Offit, I mean, the sort of cat was out of the bag. I mean, at that point, many, many people had latched on to this. And many still say, you know, the medical community is not right about this one.
Right. So you can make this argument that Dr. Wakefield raised a hypothesis, right? He's listening to the parents. The parents say, my child was fine. They got a vaccine. Now they're not fine. Could the vaccine have done it? That's a testable hypothesis. And his particular hypothesis was that the combination of measles, mumps, rubella, MMR vaccine caused autism. 17 studies now done in seven different countries, looking at hundreds of thousands of children and costing tens of millions of dollars, have looked at children who did or didn't get the MMR vaccine to see whether the rate of autism was greater in the vaccinated group. It wasn't, again and again and again. So his hypothesis was wrong. It's been refuted. And as we learned later, that his paper, which really wasn't a study at all, it was just a case series of children who had gotten the vaccine that then were diagnosed with this problem, was in fact fraudulent, that he had misrepresented clinical data, misrepresented biological data, and for that reason, his paper was withdrawn. I mean, Jenny McCarthy represents something else. What she represents is the fact that vaccines are a victim of their own success. I mean, she'll say, as she said so eloquently, I'll take the frickin' measles or influenza every time, which tells you she doesn't remember measles. I mean, measles could kill you. Before there was a measles vaccine in this country in 1963, every year there would be several million children who would get measles in the U.S., 48,000 would be hospitalized, and between 500 and 1,000 would die. That was measles. Measles was a bad disease, but she's forgotten it. And she makes it sound like the choice is to get a vaccine or to get autism. That's not true. Obviously, vaccines don't cause autism. But here's the problem. I think the problem is we don't really know the cause or causes of autism. I think you could make the analogy to diabetes in the 1800s, type 1 diabetes. We didn't know what caused diabetes. And so there were all these sort of crazy ideas for how one could cure it, all these crazy ideas for what caused it. And then in 1921, Banting and Best discovered insulin, and all that nonsense went away. And maybe for diseases like autism, where we don't have a clear cause or cure, we're going to have to wait for that to happen before all of this settles down.
So beyond Jenny McCarthy and Andrew Wakefield, your book goes well beyond that issue. You write that simple solutions, even when they're wrong, are enormously compelling. Talk about that a little bit when it comes to celebrity experts. I mean, from Gwyneth Paltrow to the medical guru Dr. Oz. I mean, what do you make of these simple solutions that many people latch onto?
You know, I think if you ask people whether you think we're going to know more about medicine and science 100 years from now than we know now, I think most people would say yes. But when it comes to their disease, they want to believe that we know everything that we need to know right now. And so, but we don't, because there's always uncertainty in medicine and at some level in science. So somebody like Andrew Wakefield or Deepak Chopra or Mehmet Oz really alleviate that fear. They know. They're gurus. They're all-knowing. It's what I call in the book the Bones-McCoy seduction. I mean, he was the chief medical officer on the USS Enterprise, and when someone had a disease, he had this tricorder, which he would scan the patient up and down. He would look at the readout, and that's what you had. No doubt about it. And that's very reassuring, even though it's wrong. I mean, Andrew Wakefield offers a cure for autism, essentially. He's got a series of cures that he offers, and he has a clear cause that he offers. And even though that's wrong, you know, medicine doesn't really have much else to offer, and therefore he becomes seductive at our risk, frankly.
Let me get a caller in here, Mark in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I'm a family physician working here in Atlanta. I've been in practice a long time and have been dealing with these issues pretty much on an everyday basis. I feel like I'm on the front lines of this in some ways. People will come in, patients will come in, have tried various home remedies, They hear about it from the internet. They hear about it from their friends. They see it in one of the vitamin stores, and they think it's going to be the cure. When we see them, give them a proper diagnosis and a proper treatment, there are instances where they simply don't believe us and would rather go back and take one of these quackery type of medicines. And it's very frustrating. And I think, if anything, the problem is getting worse.
Mm. Mark, thank you very much there from Atlanta. Paul Offit, I mean, what do you say to the doctor? This is exactly your point. I mean, I guess most people don't have the background. They don't have the time. They don't have the training to understand the scientific literature, the data. And in the age of the internet, everybody's a scientist. Just ask Dr. Google, right?
Right. No, I think Mark's experience is typical, and I agree with him. I think it is getting worse. I think people, there's an old line by Thomas Saz, who's a psychiatrist, that in the past, all of our magic looked like medicine, and today, all of our medicine looks like magic. I think you believe that you can walk into the GNC Center, and there in one of those bottles is going to be a cure for anything that ails you. And you want to believe, and I think that's part of it. I think we want to believe in the magic. And you know, because medicine has limits, because medicine doesn't have instant cures, it's nice when people like Mehmet Oz or Deepak Chopra or Andrew Wakefield or others or Gwyneth Paltrow or Suzanne Summers say this is what you need. It's natural. It's good for you. It has no side effects. And we want to believe in the magic. It's hard to argue against that because it's so seductive.
But don't you want people engaged in their healthcare? Don't you want people reading and taking in all the information they possibly can to get to the heart of their problem?
What you want them to be as informed about the subject of interest as one can be from looking at the internet. But that really doesn't replace the experience or expertise that in theory the clinician that you're going to has. So what it should make you is it should make you a better consumer in terms of asking questions. But what it shouldn't do is it shouldn't allow you really to feel that you know more than that person and that you can say something like I don't believe in vaccines as if they're a belief system. They're an evidence-based system. You don't have to believe in them. And that's where I think we get into trouble.
We're talking about science under attack this hour and what scientists can do to drown out the pseudoscience noise out there. You can join the conversation. Have you ever purchased a wellness product you saw advertised on television? Did it work? Or was it a scam? Much more after this break, including your calls. I got a board full of them. Stick with me. We'll get to you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the problem of bad scientific advice this hour and what we can do about it. You can join the conversation. How often do you turn to Dr. Google? How did that work out for you? Do you think the Trump presidency presents a unique threat to science or not? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today is Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and author of the new book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Are Not Your Best Source of Health Information. I want to play this clip here. This is Gwyneth Paltrow. Since 2008, her lifestyle line Goop has been under fire for selling products purported to help with migraines, depression, autoimmune disorders, and more. Here's Paltrow with late-night host James Corden explaining one treatment she tried for the line.
It's actually a very ancient remedy for arthritis and inflammation and scar tissue, which is that they sting you with a bee. And then if you have a bad scarring or you have inflammation, then apparently the bee sting has all these amazing healing properties.
And here is Dr. Oz from the Dr. Oz Show in 2012. He featured a green coffee extract as an effective weight loss method. The guest on that show was later fined by the Federal Trade Commission for making deceptive and unsubstantiated claims about the product. Here is Dr. Mehmet Oz.
You may think magic is make-believe, but this little bean has scientists saying they found the magic weight loss cure for every body type. It's green coffee beans. And when turned into a supplement, this miracle pill can burn fat fast for anyone who wants to lose weight. This is very exciting, and it's breaking news.
2 years later, Dr. Oz later, he defended his endorsement before a Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee hearing about consumer protection, although he said many of the products he talks about, quote, don't have the scientific muster to present as fact. A lot of callers here and some listener comment from our website. Ray says this sort of thing is an example of how the information age has done away with, to some great extent, the traditional gatekeepers of knowledge and authority. Another, the whole industry of supplements, alternative medicine, quackery, its practitioners, a lofty, self-absorbed lot invested heavily in and dependent upon their own echo chamber. Consumers beware. And from Twitter, this is just an assault on science. There is an assault on reason, and it is intentional. Well-educated, reasonable people are harder to govern. Let's go to the phones. Bill in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Glad you're on. Go ahead, sir.
I think a lot of this problem is due to the fact that our schools aren't really doing what they could be doing. We're really not teaching our population the critical thinking skills that they need, not just for, you know, evaluating these kind of issues, but all the way down the line to fake news. And, you know, I think improving our education system would go a long way to help this problem and a lot of other ills in society.
Bill, thank you. It's a good point. Paul Offit, would you respond to that? Does this come down to education, not just on this point, but really more broadly speaking?
I think Bill's exactly right. In my father's day, and to some extent in my day, I'm in my 60s, in elementary school, you were taught at some level scientific thinking, meaning, you know, you formulate a hypothesis. How does one go about testing the hypothesis? I mean, I would argue that we're all at some level scientific thinkers, right? Your radio doesn't work. Why? It's either not tuned to an active station, or it's not plugged in, or there's not batteries. And then you go about testing each of those different hypotheses. That's scientific thinking. You can't think that, you know, that my radio is not working because I didn't pay my taxes or because I didn't ingest my magic coffee bean today. I mean, that's not scientific thinking. It's magical thinking, and I think it's something that we're all prone to. So I agree with Bill. I think this is something that we can at least help ourselves out with earlier education.
Bill, thanks. Here's Amy in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Amy. Glad you called.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
Although I agree with a lot of what your guest has to say, but I have a little bit of a different perspective, just that, you know, a lot of people in this day and age have become completely disillusioned with the healthcare system, because oftentimes doctors and sometimes even scientists, you know, we don't put enough emphasis or enough education on basic health, you know, good nutrition, exercise, eating whole foods, and things like meditation and yoga, you know. And so some of the people that your guest is referring to, like Deepak Chopra or even Dr. Oz, although they might sometimes be, you know, supporting or suggesting things that maybe are quackery, a lot of what they are trying to educate people on is basic foundational health.
Basic health, basic nutrition. Amy, thank you so much. Paul Offit, how would you respond?
Well, I think to some extent he's right. I mean, I agree that you know, when you talk about mindfulness, like, you know, yoga or meditation, you know, that it's trying to, you know, to reduce stress. I think certainly that has an effect on your immune system. It has an effect on your blood pressure. So, and to the degree that people like Mehmet Oz or Deepak Chopra offer that, I think that's fine. The problem is they cross a line, and they offer, as in your previous segment, these sort of magical beans, these things that, you know, that are remarkable in their capacity. And you know, the healthcare system or your doctor is trying to sort of fool you, but I'm not going to fool you, and I'm going to give you this magical magical bean that's going to work in many ways, or Gwyneth Paltrow is going to cure your autoimmune diseases or your cancer. That's dangerous, especially when it causes you not to take medicines that really can help you. So I think that Amy's right that there is some goodness in that, but I think both of those physicians cross a line.
Amy, thanks so much for the call. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Bob Cook Deegan is a professor in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society and with the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University. Bob, thank you for being with us. I appreciate you being here.
So thanks for having me, Jane.
Well, you've been listening to this conversation. How do you see the problem of bad science, of bad medical advice, bad scientific advice? How do you see this all playing out on a policy level?
Well, I think it's a problem that's existed for a really long time. If you go back to the history of the Food and Drug Administration, there was a crisis about a century ago that led to some laws being passed about making sure our foods are safe and our drugs are safe. And then in the early 60s, it happened again with a crisis over thalidomide. And actually, healthcare is one of the places where we actually do believe in collecting evidence and making decisions based on that evidence before we allow things to go on the market. But a lot of the things that we're talking about today that I've heard in this conversation are the things that either fall outside of that or where there's a piece of misinformation, like the vaccine issues that Dr. Offit is so familiar with, where a piece of misinformation gets injected into the system and then it gets really, really hard to get rid of it because belief systems proliferate and people start believing what they want to believe. And I think we're in kind of a wave of where the reliance on science is a little bit less ingrained in our culture than it was maybe a decade ago.
Hmm. I want to play this clip from Earth Day. This is from April 2017. More than a million people descended on the nation's capital and in cities across the world, really, to protest President Donald Trump and his administration's hostility to science. Here's Lucky Tran, is a molecular biologist at Columbia University who helped plan the March for Science, speaking with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly about his motivations.
I think the profession of science is under attack. And why is that happening? Because we've really ceded the floor. We haven't engaged in politics. We've left that open for politicians to come in and really hijack and obfuscate science for their own selfish needs.
So, Bob, how much responsibility should scientists take themselves? You hear that, scientists saying, you know, we've ceded the floor. We haven't engaged in the process or the politics of this. How much responsibility should medicine and science take for this?
I think a fair amount, although we can't solve the whole problem within the professional communities. But I will say I was at that march, and I think people are mobilized and realize that there actually is a threat to the idea that evidence should be the basis for making a lot of important decisions. And there are certain domains where that's still kind of okay, but climate change and embryo research and a few other hot-button issues, the role of science is part of a mix of really, really complicated political and volatile issues. And there's a lot of disagreement, and it's really hard to find the facts sometimes in the swirl of the rhetoric.
Paul Offit,
so I do think scientists and physicians can do a lot in this most recent election cycle, the one that we're in the middle of right now. A whole bunch of people from science and medicine have started running for elective office, which I think is terrific.
Mm. Paul Offit, what have you learned about engaging with the anti-science community, and what have you learned over the years about what works and what doesn't work in those conversations?
Yeah, you know, I think as a scientist, so your training in many ways is the opposite of what it takes to be good at sort of weighing in with the public or with the media, because you're trained really to sort of stick to your data, never go beyond your data. It makes for people who it sound like they're waffling at some level. So, for example, if you have to do an epidemiological study, you can never really so-called accept the null hypothesis, or said another way, you can never prove never. So when you go into the media, and you I've heard this at congressional subcommittee hearings, the scientists will say all the evidence to date doesn't support the hypothesis that MMR causes autism. And it sounds like you're waffling, or worse, it sounds like you're covering something up, because you know you can never really say MMR doesn't cause autism because you can never prove never. So I think, the way that we're trained is almost the opposite of what you need to do to get out there and be a powerful advocate. It's and also the scientist's personality really is not one that lends itself to this. I mean, I was, I inoculated mice in a windowless concrete blocked room for 20 years. That wasn't exactly training for being on the Colbert Report, which right. I was on a couple times.
Right. I hear you. Let's get Stephen here from Annapolis, Maryland. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. This speaks so true to my own profession as a behavior analyst. Now, I'm not able to prescribe medication, but I deal pretty much solely with those with autism. And I'm in the home with these families using scientific data as well as the scientific process to drive every intervention I do, to anything from communication to maladaptive behavior. And I see time in and time again, even from educated families. And I also deal within the Baltimore setting, too, with impoverished families. And it's the sense of these vitamins and these quick fixes. And the worst part about it is that if I'm in your home, it's because I don't have the easiest of answers to give you. I have a long process to work with you on. Mm-hmm. But I have to make sure I'm ethically bound to ensure the fact that they understand the information that they're given. And even in that case, I still see that they are resistant. And I think it really stems from not only what a caller said from a lack of education from the ground up, but also from the idea that the easiest path is the one that we will always choose. And so if there is a quick fix, such as like a vitamin or yoga or whatever Gwyneth Paltrow was talking about,
we'll take that. We'll take that instead. Steve, thank you very much for that call. Let's go to Sean in Orland, Maine. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
Thanks. I think that part of the problem that some of the doctors and the people in the medical industry might be coming up against is a lost trust in the medical industry due to the corporatization of the whole system. When the drugs are every other commercial on TV is someone trying to sell us a drug, and we see the ridiculous profits, in the pharmaceutical industry. Suddenly ideas like, oh, maybe GMO foods are designed to make us sick just so they can sell us more drugs, suddenly they don't sound so crazy. So I think if we had a different setup where we could see that, the industry was really about helping people and taking care of health as opposed to profits.
As opposed to the financial gain. Sean, thank you very much. Bob Cook Deegan, how do you combat this problem of bad science and bad advice? What do you do?
I think there's a kernel of truth in two aspects of what was just raised. One is, in fact, part of the dynamic is the democratization of information through the internet, and people have ready access to it. And at the same time, a really, really strong self-promotional culture and anything goes. And science is one of the places where you're still supposed to go back to the evidence. And I don't want us to give up that training of, let's find out what the world is telling us before we make a decision about what we're going to do. And I think we don't want to give that up as scientists, but Dr. Off is absolutely right. Our training is not about how to interact with political systems. But the other layer that's on top of that is the commercialism. And I think that the level of trust, this is verified in all sorts of polling and stuff like that, the level of trust in large corporate entities has been plummeting, and particularly in the drug and vaccine business. And that's been going on for 20 years, and I think we're at a point where it's beginning to affect the politics in a big way, in a way that it hasn't probably for the last 20 years nearly as seriously. The drug pricing crisis is bipartisan. It's out there, and it's front and center in the national debate now.
Here is President Donald Trump. Since assuming the presidency, he's not clarified his stance on the existence of climate change. But as a private citizen, he tweeted that, quote, global warming was a hoax on multiple occasions. Here is then candidate Trump at a campaign rally in Hilton Head, South Carolina in 2015.
So Obama's talking about all of this with the global warming and that. And a lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry, okay? It's a hoax.
Paul Offit, you write that the president has ushered in a new wave of anti-science activism. Concerning to you, I presume?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what he's allowed basically is for people to sort of be more comfortable about declaring their own truths, as he has. I mean, he's claimed that vaccines cause autism. He certainly has now, as you heard in that segment, you know, he's claimed that climate change is a hoax. You know, you have a head of the Department of Education, which is probably the most depressing, who is a creationist, who's willing to deny 250,000 years of fossil records. So that's a problem. And I think he hasn't created it, but I think he's allowed more easily for the expression of it.
So, Bob Cook, Deegan, I know you have to run. How should individuals in our culture approach this problem? How should we discern fact from fiction, fake experts from real experts when it comes to science?
You know, I think it's a cultural phenomenon where we've got this flood of information and we're just going to have to relearn the basic skills of critical thinking. I just think we can't let go of it. I think we're losing a little bit at the margin in that war right now. But the fact is, you know, things wax and wane, and I think we're at the outer wave of a kind of an anti-science, anti-evidence ideology. But I guess I have a fair amount of faith in our democratic system that we're actually going to swing back when some of the mistakes that are made under that mode become more apparent. And I think climate change is going to be one of them.
Bob Cook Deegan, professor in the School for the Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State University. Thank you so much, Bob. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Paul Offit, stick with me. After the break, we're going to look at the possibility of another global pandemic outbreak or plague. Is it inevitable? Are we ready? Listeners, you can join that conversation as well. Is preparing for a pandemic a global problem? Or is it every country for itself? More after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the challenges of separating scientific fact from fiction this hour, and you can join the conversation. Do you worry that the U.S. is letting down its guard when it comes to the possibility of a global pandemic or an outbreak that kills potentially millions of people? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, author of the new book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. A lot of calls and comments from Twitter. Jody says, we've had a couple of medical issues in our family in the last few months and had unfortunate experiences with several medical professionals. Very hard to trust any of their advice, so why not try Dr. Oz? Another says, I suspect one of the reasons alternative medicine is appealing is because the people practicing it, in quotes, tend to be much more attentive to their patients and spend more time with them. That means a lot of people who are suffering from something that seems to not have a specifically proven solution. William is in Mildredgeville, Virginia, Georgia. Hi, William. I hope I got that right.
Yes, Jane. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In 2012, my highly educated daughter was 42 and discovered she had aggressive colon cancer. And she put off conventional treatment for almost a year because she personally knew a man who built an industry on hands-on healing. And when she finally agreed to the, he said his treatment wouldn't work if you had chemo or radiation. When she finally agreed to it, she spent the last 15 months of her life getting the treatment and stuff, and she died in 2014. Mm. But she knew this man since the 80s. He was one of her college professors. But anyway.
Mm. What a story.
Also, being highly educated, she spent her whole life going with organic and buying every supplement that was supposed to be proven to work and everything. I sometimes wonder if the supplements didn't contribute to a cancer.
William, thank you very much for that call. Nikki's in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that part of the problem that I see happening is an issue with healthcare in general. I have personally been to doctors who were wonderful at first, being able to take lots and lots of time with you. And over time, they're pushed to take more and more patients. They don't get to take the time. And that often leads to them not being able to find an answer for you. I've had on three separate occasions problems that a doctor told me, I don't know, come back when it happens again. And then I was able to successfully figure it out on my own with resources online, and then confirmed that that was the actual answer after the fact with my doctor. And so I think that creates a lot of problems when you go to try to seek help, and the doctor just doesn't have the time and says, I'm sorry, just come back later.
Nikki, thank you. Paul Offit, you know, she has a good point.
She does. I mean, I remember when I was a little boy, my pediatrician would come to our house and make house calls. He saw where I lived. He interacted with my parents, and it was hands on. And now, if you go to a doctor, I've been to a doctor recently where, you know, they're just staring at the computer and they're typing all the stuff in they need to type in the computer. Sometimes you feel they're not even looking at you. And as your caller said, there's a limited amount of time, and so therefore there is less trust engendered, and you do feel you're just a number. And I think it is part of the problem. I agree.
Thanks so much for the call, Nikki. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Washington, Ed Yong, staff writer for The Atlantic. He covers science. His latest piece is titled, The Next Plague is Coming. Is America Ready? You can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Ed, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us about the story you reported. What'd you do? Where'd you go? Who did you talk to?
So I wrote this piece about whether America is ready for the next big pandemic. So infectious disease threats are mounting. There are lots to be concerned about, whether it's a new type of flu, whether it's something like Ebola. And I wanted to understand what actually goes into becoming prepared for these threats and how America is faring. I talked to lots of people around the country. I went to a hospital that is perhaps one of the best prepared in the country for dealing with these kinds of threats. And I also traveled to the Democratic Republic of Congo, a country that has repeatedly dealt with these kinds of conditions and is currently in the middle of its ninth Ebola outbreak.
Right. And we don't hear much about it. I mean, this Ebola outbreak is ravaging Western Africa. Why aren't we hearing as much about it this time?
So the current Ebola outbreak is in the Congo, which is central. It's sort of leveled off at the moment. The outbreak is the ninth in the country's history, and the country is very, very experienced at dealing with it. The West African outbreak from 2014 to 2016 was a very different situation, much, much bigger in scope. Ebola is a very infamous disease. It speaks to some of the issues that you've already been raising in this segment about misinformation, that there's a lot of paranoia and a lot of false conceptions about it, about its symptomology, about how it spreads. And getting that good information out there is very tricky in the middle of an outbreak. Mm.
Talk to us about the 1918 influenza pandemic. It infected about 500 million people worldwide, killed 50 to 100 million of them. Here we are 100 years later. The world has become much more globalized and connected. Our science has become better, too. And yet, are we more or less susceptible to a global pandemic today?
In some ways, things are a little bit better. We obviously have had a century of medical advances to build upon. But in many ways, the world is still disturbingly vulnerable. We rely on a just-in-time economy where supplies are very limited. As an example, when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, it also knocked out a large proportion of our supply of IV bags. So IV bags went into shortage. Because of that, people started having to deliver fluids through syringes, and syringes then experienced a shortage too. So we are very vulnerable in lots of the advances that we've come to rely upon. And our preparation for diseases like flu, like the next possible flu pandemic, are surprisingly thin. We run into the cycle of panic and neglect, where a crisis hits, we make investments and we pay attention to it, but then things subside, and so too does our attention. And investments in this area need to be stable over time, and they just aren't. There isn't that political will to keep preparedness up.
You mentioned those IV bags. Here is the former Center for Disease Control and Prevention head, Tom Frieden, telling CNBC earlier this year that there are lessons that can be learned from the shortage of IV fluid bags created by Hurricane Maria's destruction of Puerto Rico.
If you have a just-in-time delivery system, you're going to have a problem when you have a surge. So you have to anticipate surges like flu and build up your stock before them,
right,
and come up with redundant systems. In an emergency, you don't want to be breaking the glass and trying something new. You want to have a robust system that you can scale up when needed.
So there are intravenous bags manufactured in Puerto Rico that, went into shortage after Hurricane Maria. I mean, there are all sorts of issues that can happen. The most common life-saving drugs, I know you've written about, Ed, they all depend on long supply chains that include India and China and many other places, chains that can be very easily broken in a severe pandemic. Speak to that for a moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just part of the many sort of frailties of the modern world that a very contagious pathogen might be able to exploit. We just don't have the safety net in place to protect us. Things might be okay for a bit, but we are strangely vulnerable. I think perhaps more vulnerable than people might expect. There are things in place, but even for something like flu, in the last big pandemic from 2009, that was a relatively mild virus, but we didn't really see it coming. It took several months to spot its presence in the States. We weren't able to ramp up the production of vaccines in time, and hospitals were remarkably stretched thin. They didn't break, but the healthcare system did take a knock from something that was kind of a training wheels pandemic.
On average, a new infectious disease has emerged every year for the past 30 years. You write, the total number of outbreaks per decade has now more than tripled since the 1980s. In your piece in The Atlantic, Ed, you mentioned Bill Gates, whose foundation has studied pandemics closely, and he's not a man given to alarmism. What did he say?
So, Bill Gates' view is one of global progress, but he feels that in terms of preparing for pandemics, we just don't have our act together, and pandemic threats are what he feels is most likely to cause a really significant number of deaths in a short amount of time. And I think he understands that really crucially, to prepare any one country to deal with these threats, we need to safeguard the entire world, because we live in an age of incredible globalization, or very easy international travel. And it's an age where a disease that starts up in one country can very easily spread around the entire world. So we need, and by we, I mean in richer countries like America, need to invest in the health security of other nations to help them control their own diseases and to avoid these kinds of spreads.
Let me get Anne in here from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, please go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. So I kind of want to tie together what you've been talking about, because if we're talking about preventing a pandemic, then we need to look at preventative medicine as well. I've come to find that every time I go to a doctor, people who go in there are already sick. They're already needing a cure for something, and they get thrown a Band-Aid. You have a fever. Let's take a pain pill for it. They're not really getting, healing medications. They're just getting cover-up medications. And I think that's why people are turning away from some of the harder science stuff, because you look at studies like Barnholt and Matheson, where they spent 5 years studying homeopathics, and they said it should be included on health insurance policies. and other people who are, you know, reducing and getting rid of tumors through fasting and plant-based diets. So it comes down to, I think people aren't turning away from science. They're just wanting a more balanced perspective from science that looks into the preventative side of medicine.
Anne, thank you. Dr. Paul Offit, jump back in here. What do you make of Anne's comments, and how do you see the common thread through this conversation?
Right. So I think that she, to some extent, buys into the magic. I mean, if there were clear, say, plant-based cures to treat or prevent cancer, then they would be used. There's no interest in the medical community in doing anything other than trying to help people that have these diseases. And certainly preventive medicine is largely ignored. I do agree with that, in large part because there's not the time or maybe even not the instruction for clinicians that are out there practicing this. So I mean, I would argue vaccines are an example of preventive medicine, but so is exercise and good diet, et cetera. I think once, you know, the sort of homeopathy is a perfect example of what isn't. I mean, homeopathy, it was created by Samuel Hahnemann in the 1800s, and it's based on sort of taking a product and diluting it to the point that it's not there anymore. So it's a placebo, which is not to say that placebos aren't of value, but you certainly don't want to treat them where you have a medicine that actually could work. So I think that's the balance. I do think we have lost people's trust. I do think we spend less time, and I do think that we don't emphasize preventive medicine, and maybe all of that has led us into this world where we do allow, you know, sort of have encouraged or allowed to have happen this sort of magical thinking, which I think doesn't help us.
Ed, what are your thoughts on that?
I would totally agree. I think that there is there is no desire among people in the medical profession to avoid things that could genuinely help. And you know, Paul talked a lot about vaccines. I think vaccines are important to talk about here, especially in terms of pandemic risks like flu. There are flu vaccines available. It is very hard to tailor them to a new strain that we've never seen before, and that is rapidly spreading around the world, which is why the ultimate goal for vaccine research in terms of pandemic preparedness is creating a universal flu vaccine. That is still a long time away. There are a lot of very clever people working on it right now, but that is something that I think is going to be incredibly useful. That would take off some of the most important pandemic risks off the table if it could be realistically achieved.
Dr. Paul Offit, you co-invented a vaccine. I think it was the rotavirus vaccine. So you know a bit about this. I mean, I think about the flu vaccine in terms of a pandemic, a global pandemic. The flu vaccine that's made now is by growing viruses in chicken eggs, right? It's the same archaic method that's been used for 70 years. I mean, doesn't that sort of process need to evolve and innovate to a new age?
Most definitely. I mean, you know, if there were a surge, as Ed stated in his wonderful article, that you need a lot of flu vaccine quickly. There's one mammalian cell-based vaccine. There's one, you know, recombinant DNA-based vaccine. But virtually all of the vaccine comes from relying on hens to lay eggs, and that puts us at some risk. So I think you're right. We do need to evolve. And you know, you're always doing this on the fly with the flu pandemic. And you know that there's going to be roughly three pandemics every century. You know that. You just don't know when. So, you know, you need to react quickly and well.
Ed Young, I'll give you the last word here. We're talking about pandemics and global viruses that spread quickly. Ebola, H1N1, West Nile, Zika. Are we ready? Is America ready? Is the world ready, for that matter, for another plague or pandemic?
I don't think we are ready now. I think with the best will in the world, we are not. But we could be. This doesn't have to be a thing that we are bad at. But it does take continual investment and sustained investment in things that aren't too sexy, like public health, like global health, in trying to build up the capacities of other countries to control their own diseases and to control their own outbreaks. And that's what we need to channel money into.
Ed Young, staff writer for The Atlantic, covers science. His latest piece is titled "The Next Plague is Coming. Is America Ready?" Great reporting, Ed. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Center's Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, co-author of the new book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Really appreciate your time today and your work on this book, Paul. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.